Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. This is a direct appeal of a final judgment following a jury trial in November of 2004. At that time, Mr. Peters, my client, was found guilty of robbing the Hillstop convenience store on the Menominee Indian Reservation in Wisconsin. He was sentenced to 72 months imprisonment and ordered to pay $18,000 in restitution, approximately. It's our contention that the district court committed reversible error on two grounds. The first ground is a constitutional ground. We contend that the district court violated the separation of powers principles by including sentencing allegations in the superseding indictment entered against Mr. Peters. Mr. Peters was convicted under Section 1154 and Section 2111. Section 1154 is a jurisdictional provision. Section 2111 contains the actual offense. And the original indictment entered against him followed the language of Section 2111 almost to the letter. And that original indictment is attached to our brief as page 2 of our short appendix. The original indictment says that Mr. Peters willfully took money from the presence of another by intimidation. And that mirrors the language of the offense almost perfectly. If Mr. Peters had gone to trial on that indictment, there wouldn't have been a problem. But unfortunately, there were several delays in going to trial, and in the interim, the court decided Blakely versus Washington. In an attempt to comply with Blakely's mandate, the government entered a superseding indictment in July of 2004, which contained sentencing allegations taken from Section 2B3 of the guidelines. The superseding indictment contained language such as brandished weapon, physically restrained in order to facilitate escape, and an accusation that Mr. Peters stole in excess of $30,000. Now, none of this language appears in the actual offense as defined by Section 2111. And it's our contention that including this language in the superseding indictment allowed the court and the independent sentencing commission to expand and define the elements of a federal offense.
Those weren't alleged to be elements, though, were they?
They were not actually elements of the offense, but they were attached to the indictment. They were included in the language of the first page of the indictment, and specific facts such as Mr. Peters brandished a PVC pipe, and Mr. Peters locked the manager of the convenience store in the office to facilitate his escape.
Can we look at the bottom line? In other words, how could the sentencing factors in the indictment be plain error when they didn't involve the introduction of any additional evidence other than the evidence that was properly admitted for the offense itself? In other words, what possible prejudice could there be?
Judge, there's two prejudices, and I'm going to have to give you a long answer to a short question. The first prejudice is a pure constitutional prejudice. It's the fact that Mr. Peters stands accused and convicted of an offense that was not defined by Congress. And under Article 1, only Congress has the authority to make law. There may be an argument that this is merely surplusage, but I would argue that it's not mere surplusage. It may be surplusage in the fact that it shouldn't have been there, but it's prejudicial surplusage in that it changes the nature of the offense. It makes Mr. Peters as an accused stand trial for an offense that has not been defined by statute and by Congress, but instead by basically federal common law.
But this isn't a case in which the guidelines factors were unrelated to the offense of conviction and prejudicial in nature, and that's what we've got to look at here, isn't it?
Your Honor, I would say that the second part of my answer to your first question may address that. The fact that these sentencing guidelines were included in the superseding indictment opened the door for real prejudice at the time of trial, in that they allowed the court to describe and define these sensational sentencing terms, such as brandished a weapon, physically restrained, serious bodily injury, at the time of giving jury instructions and in special verdict questions given to the jury. Your Honor, it's one thing.
You're not claiming that the question could not be posed during examination of witness, did he brandish a weapon?
No, not at all, Judge.
And therefore, also, the jury could have been given interrogatories, as they were, asking whether or not they found beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant brandished a weapon, right?
Not at all, Your Honor. Our contention is that if these elements had come in through evidence, in the normal course of trial, through witnesses and documents and even Mr. Peters' own statement, there wouldn't be the same level of prejudice. That's the normal course of trial. Where the prejudice arises, in our view, is when the judge gives these sentencing guideline terms to the jury during instructions. This is a time when the trial judge is given the great deference by the jury. He's at the height of his influence.
Well, yes, but as in any indictment, they're instructed that's no proof of guilt. It's just merely the charge, right?
Your Honor, I would argue that the timing of the instructions given by the judge and the combination of the timing with the judge's influence created a real risk of prejudice here. The sentencing terms should be kept separate from the jury determination. The Sentencing Commission's role has been debated and discussed to no end, Judge. And the Sentencing Commission has definitely been delegated duties to promote uniformity in sentencing, to assist trial judges with sentencing during the sentencing phase. But this is after the determination of guilt. It's after the jury's fact-finding mission is complete. There's no authority that I know of that gives the Sentencing Commission authority to write substantive criminal statutes or to include the terminology of the guidelines in instructions given to the jury prior to the determination of guilt. The sentencing factors may be realistic factors to base a sentence on, and the court in Booker has said that they're advisory and that the court should definitely follow them when possible, but they're not intended to be definitional components of jury instructions. Once they were included in the jury instructions here, it skewered the proceedings, it skewered the fact-finding process, in our view, to an extent that it affected the fairness and the integrity of the trial. And that's where the prejudice comes in, Your Honor. If I may, I would like to address the second argument in our brief, and that's the fact that Mr. Peters Mr. Peters brought a motion to suppress statements made after he requested counsel, which was denied by the district court. In this case, Mr. Peters was arrested and taken to the tribal police station on the Indian reservation and interrogated by an officer named Officer Mullins.
We need to talk about Davis. You need to address the Davis case.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not suggesting that Mr. Peters' statements in this case I'm not suggesting that Davis isn't good law. We suggest that Mr. Peters' statements in this case are sufficient under Davis. And Davis requires that the suspect articulate a desire for counsel sufficiently clearly for a reasonable officer to understand in the circumstances.
In other words, there's nothing ambiguous about the statement. Nothing ambiguous.
You know, I would concede that it wasn't very eloquent, but in the context of the interrogation, I don't think there was. And if I can give you some background, after Mr. Peters was taken to the police station, Agent Mullins began his interrogation. And during that time, he discussed with Mr. Peters the procedure of how this was going to work.
Right.
And he suggested to Mr. Peters that at some point he was going to be taken to Green Bay for pretrial services and a review to see if he was qualified financially to receive counsel. Your Honor, this implanted the notion that Mr. Peters could not receive counsel until he was taken to Green Bay.
Well, those aren't the exact words, are they? Or, you know, I mean, couldn't the statement have mean that he just wanted to get past the interview and processing stage? I mean, isn't that what was explained to him? That he'd be taken to Green Bay. Once there, he'd be interviewed by pretrial services to determine whatever.
Your Honor, Mr. Peters and Agent Mullen didn't discuss Green Bay in any other context. In Mr. Peters' mind, the opportunity to go to Green Bay was synonymous with the opportunity to gain counsel. Mr. Peters' actual statement to Agent Mullins was, I'd like to get to that part now, or I'd like to get to the Green Bay part now, if you read the full context of the discussion. This was an unequivocal request. There's nothing ambiguous about that in the terms of their discussion. And it's unequivocal in the sense, and under Davis, in that Mr. Peters did not say, I might like to go to Green Bay, or maybe someday I would like to go to Green Bay. He said, I would like to get to the Green Bay part now. There's nothing equivocal about that in the context. I think it's also important to note that the decisions have said that there are no magic words when a suspect is trying to invoke his right to counsel. There's no exact formula. The context is crucial, and in this context, between Agent Mullins and Mr. Peters, there could be no doubt that Mr. Peters was invoking his right to counsel.
Well, but he was given his Miranda warning and knew you have the right to an attorney and so forth. I mean, it isn't like he hadn't heard the kind of language necessary to request one, right? He didn't say anything about an attorney, I want a lawyer, I want to be represented.
Certainly, Judge. There's no required time for the accused to make the request for counsel. The case law says almost uniformly that when the accused or the suspect finally does make that request, the interrogation should stop. There's no exact time you should make it. There's no right time.
Well, my point is, it isn't like this conversation about Green Bay occurred in a vacuum. He was already advised of his right to an attorney. The language, I'd like to have an attorney, I'd like to have a lawyer, I want counsel. I mean, it wasn't that he couldn't have determined how to ask for one.
Certainly, I guess there was maybe the opportunity for him to hear Agent Mullins discuss his Miranda rights, but again, there's no requirement that he uses words like attorney or counsel or lawyer. The context is the key, and in this context, the two men had discussed Green Bay only as an opportunity to gain counsel. Agent Mullins understood that that's what Green Bay meant. Mr. Peters understood that that's what Green Bay meant. And when he said to Agent Mullins, I'd like to get to that part now, or I'd like to get to the Green Bay part now, a reasonable officer in that situation should have understood in the context, and the interrogation should have stopped. If there are no other questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Mr. Fong?
May it please the Court, my name is Tim Funnell. I'm an Assistant United States Attorney in the Green Bay Division of the Eastern District of Wisconsin. I represent the United States in this appeal. I was also trial counsel for the Lawrence Peters case. We are requesting that the Court find that there was not plain error committed here by including the sentencing allegations in the indictment. We are also requesting the Court to find no plain error in the submission of those sentencing allegations to the jury. Finally, we are asking the Court to find that the District Court did not err when it denied the defendant's motion to suppress his statements.
Could we get to the Green Bay part now? Okay. Because the magistrate relied in part on the evidence that Peters had been arrested a number of times and had invoked his right to counsel in order to stop questioning. But is that even a proper consideration, given that the Supreme Court in Davis declared that it's an objective inquiry, not a subjective inquiry, an objective inquiry, you know, whether at that time a reasonable person would construe it to be an expression of a desire for counsel?
You are correct, Your Honor, that it is an objective standard. It's an objective standard under the totality of the circumstances, and in the totality of these circumstances, it is appropriate. And the case law has held that the Court can and should consider things such as the arrested person's previous contacts with law enforcement. So it was an appropriate consideration for the District Court and the magistrate to consider. And in this particular case, there was testimony, and the magistrate found that Mr. Peters had been arrested a number of times before. The testimony in the record was at least 8 separate times, and that he had requested counsel before. In response to the court's earlier questions regarding the issue of going to Green Bay and counsel's suggestion that this was, in Mr. Peters' mind, synonymous with getting counsel, Mr. Peters' own testimony is contrary to that. At the evidentiary hearing, at pages 90 to 92 of the evidentiary hearing transcript, when I was questioning Mr. Peters, I asked him specifically, I went over the Miranda form with him while he was on the stand, and I asked him if he understood each one of those rights, because they had been read to him twice, not just once, but twice. And twice he had waived his Miranda rights. He testified that he understood that. And then I made the point with him, Mr. Peters, so you understood that you did not have to wait until you got to Green Bay before you got an attorney. And his answer to that was yes. So it was not clear in Mr. Peters' mind that he had to wait to get to Green Bay before he got a lawyer. Quite the contrary, he knew he could have a lawyer appointed for him even before he got to Green Bay.
But, if Green Bay and pretrial services were discussed only in the context of how he could obtain a lawyer, would that should be a consideration that those references were synonymous with obtaining counsel? I mean, like, if his statement was, I'd like to get to the lawyer part now, would that have been ambiguous?
I don't think that would have been ambiguous. And context is very important. Defense counsel cites the Smith case and the Alvarez case as examples where the defendant did not have to use the word attorney or the word lawyer. But what's significant in those particular cases is when the accused had this conversation with the police officer. In those cases, it was either during the Miranda advisement or immediately following the Miranda advisement. In Mr. Peters' case, the difference is that it wasn't until 30 minutes into the interview, 30 minutes after he had received his second Miranda warning, that he made the statement, I'd like to get to that Green Bay part now. So again, the context is very important, and it's the officer's duty to comply with Miranda. And Davis makes clear that the subject of the interview also has a duty. He has a duty to make his point clear and unambiguous, and Mr. Peters simply failed to do that. So under Davis, the officer had no obligation to stop the questioning. He could continue questioning Mr. Peters without violating Davis. I'd like to turn to the sentencing allegation issue, unless there are any other questions on the right to counsel issue. The sentencing allegations were certainly part of the superseding indictment. The sentencing allegations were certainly read to the jury as part of the jury instructions. But it's significant, as the court has already pointed out this morning, that none of the evidence supporting those sentencing allegations was introduced exclusively to support the sentencing allegation. Rather, the evidence was going to come in during the government's case. The elements, the court made it clear, I am going to define for you, members of the jury, these are the elements of the charge of robbery. At no point did the court suggest to the jury, and the record certainly does not suggest this, that somehow a common law crime was created here. The elements of robbery were not contested, and they were submitted to the jury. The jury was told, you have to find each one of these four elements before you can return a verdict of guilty as to the robbery count. At that point, and only that point, if you return a verdict of guilty, do you reach the question of sentencing allegations. And it was in the context of those questions that the jury had special verdict questions. And again, they were told these have to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt. The judge, as the court has noted, told the jurors, the indictment is not proof of guilt. It is simply a charge, nothing more. So there is nothing sensational about what was done in this particular case. Counsel uses the term sensational.
Seemed like a good idea at the time, right?
In the context of this case, Your Honor, it made perfect sense for the court not to bifurcate the guilt portion and the sentencing allegation portion. I can certainly think of cases where there would be sentencing guideline issues in between the Blakely and Booker cases if this had come up. For example, if there was a relevant conduct issue in a drug case, where you would want to separate those out because there could be evidence coming in on relevant conduct that would not have been part of the government's case. It would have been irrelevant. It would have been inadmissible. That was not the case here. It certainly made sense for the district court to do it this way, and the defense never objected to it. Unless there are any other questions, Your Honor, I would stand on my brief and ask the court to affirm the district court's denial of suppression and also ask the court to affirm the defendant's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fallon. Mr. Meehan? How much time? You have 2 minutes, Mr. Meehan.
Your Honors, I'll address first counsel's argument about the testimony of Mr. Peters at trial. The magistrate judge, after hearing the testimony of the parties and Mr. Peters, rejected Mr. Peters' version of the story outright. We're not arguing that Mr. Peters' story of how the interrogation went is something that the court should consider. There's a footnote in our brief that suggests that Mr. Peters' version of the story is very different from the story offered by Agent Mullins, but we're willing to accept Agent Mullins' version of the story, which is, I'd like to get to the Green Bay part now, and say that even if you accept that, it still satisfies Davis.
What was his version of what he asked for?
Mr. Peters would say that he more specifically requested counsel a number of times. As far as counsel's point about the request coming 30 minutes into the interview, I think we've covered that already. There's no right time to make the request, but when the request does happen, the officer should stop interrogation if he understands it to be a request. Finally, with regard to the sentencing allegations, in a case like this where there's a risk of prejudice, and we believe there was a very real risk of prejudice, if the government wants a jury to rule on sentencing language instead of including it in jury instructions or including it in an indictment, it's easy to bifurcate the trial and have the jury rule on the actual sentencing allegations after the verdict, after the determination of guilt or innocence. The court in Booker has said there's no novelty in a separate jury trial with regard to the sentence. In a case like this where the prejudice is so great, the court should have had a separate hearing, bring the jury back the next day, have them look at these allegations if the government wants them to be considered, and have the jury look at this in a pure sentencing context rather than mixing it in with the determination of guilt or innocence prior to the verdict. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Meehan. Again, thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement, and we move to the fourth case today, Marlos versus